I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Here are some sobering statistics. The prison population in the United States has increased by 500% since the 1970s, giving the country the highest rate of incarceration in the world. About half are behind bars for nonviolent crimes. According to a recent article in the New York Times, one in 40 children in this country have a parent in prison. For African American children, that number is one in 15. Young black men who haven't graduated from high school are more likely to be in prison than have a job. There are growing concerns from a number of quarters that this high rate of incarceration is hurting poor communities, overwhelming families of prisoners, and have left inmates who have served time with few job prospects. All that can increase the rate of crime. So is it time to rethink incarceration and public safety? We have three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio, and let me introduce them to you. Keith Reeves is an associate professor of political science, faculty director of the Center for Social and Policy Studies at Swarthmore College, currently working on a book that explores incarceration trends among black males. And Keith Reeves, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. Jane Siegel, associate professor of criminology at Rutgers University in Camden, wrote a book called Disrupted Childhoods, Children of Women in Prison. And Jane Siegel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. And rounding out our trio of guests, Heather Ann Thompson, Associate Professor of History in the Departments of African American Studies and History at Temple University. And her work focuses on the history of mass incarceration. And Heather Ann Thompson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Great to be here.
Heather, let me begin with you, and if it's possible, to ask a historian to give a very short history lesson here. But what happened in the 60s and even early 70s that led to these tougher crime laws?
Well, it's a complicated question, as you might imagine, but in short, we had a situation where the crime rates in the early to mid-60s were pretty stable, not particularly alarming, but what we did have was a tremendous amount of civil rights unrest. We had a tremendous amount of what was perceived to be social upheaval, social disruption, and the response to that was to turn to the legal system and effectively to begin a war on crime with the passage of the Law Enforcement Administration Act in 1965, and that in turn fundamentally changed the policing of public spaces, which then leads to mass incarceration.
And I guess we're talking about things like mandatory minimums, tougher drug laws, all of that kind of combining together to create this high rate of incarceration?
Right. So the one people most know about is the drug war, particularly the so-called Rockefeller drug laws beginning in 73. And that's a fundamental reason why prison rates rise. But that's not just it. It's a more widespread criminalizing of urban spaces. So things that used to be maybe unsavory become illegal. Things that were illegal have much higher penalties. And we begin to criminalize spaces like schools. Schools that had a lot of civil rights unrest end up with police forces that in turn will contribute to this rise in prison population.
Things like zero tolerance.
Exactly.
That's all part of what we're talking about here. Let me turn to you, Keith Reeves, because just to what I said in my introduction, that the incarceration rate has increased by 500% in the last couple of decades. I mean, just I'm still trying to absorb that information.
Yeah, it's just an amazingly alarming number. I mean, I've been working with black males, mentoring them in several correctional facilities across the state for the last decade or so. And it is sobering to spend time with them to see the collateral damage that is done to them, their families, their children, to the communities in which they eventually will return. 95% of these individuals will return home. And we've got to grapple with that issue.
And I'm curious about the kind of people that you have been working with. Generally speaking, what are they in prison for?
They're in prison primarily for, low-level drug offenses, primarily. A lot of them have substance alcohol abuse, which is another issue we have to tackle, and the connection there. But they are primarily coming from poor, as Heather said, urban spaces. Not all of them. Some of them have dropped out of high school, and they have very low skill sets. And they're being returned to communities that are already under such siege, pressure, poverty, crime, and so forth. So we've got to get at some systemic issues.
Well, and Jane, you work in Camden, which, of course, is living this in many ways. Help
That's
us understand
right.
what's going on in Camden.
That's right. Well, Camden it receives a lot of attention as being a city that is really plagued by crime, but it's plagued by a lot of other social ills, as Heather was saying, that it's a community that has very few resources to help combat the conditions that give rise to these high levels of crime. And so it's really facing a crisis in some sense of, because there's so many neighborhoods where there's so many people who are incarcerated, and it really frays the fabric of those neighborhoods. It has a really pernicious effect that extend way beyond just the person who goes to prison.
In fact, you've looked at women who are in prison and I guess the impact of that on their children. Is
yes.
it possible to summarize that impact?
Well, it's, first of all, there's a huge population of children in the country who have experienced parental incarceration. The government estimates that there are 1.7 million children who have a parent in prison at a given moment, but that doesn't include kids whose parents are in prison. So there's more than 2 million children, but we think that there's probably upwards of 10 million children who have experienced parental incarceration at some time in their life. So, and when we look by race, it's really dramatic because, for example, a child born in 1990, a black child born in 1990, 50% of them would have experienced parental incarceration by the time they were 14. Mm. And black children are 6 to 7 times more likely to have a parent in prison. So it's having a really disproportionate impact on black communities. But so there's a lot of children who potentially could be affected by any negative consequences of parental incarceration. And certainly it's a traumatic experience for children when they are separated from their parent for whatever reason. And incarceration has an additional dimension of being associated with a lot of stigma, so that the families oftentimes can't rely on others because they keep it hidden, so the social support that they get is bad. But they suffer psychological consequences and certainly behavioral consequences as well.
And I want to pick up on that. But Heather, let me go back to you. So has the fact that there are so many more people in prison, has that made this a safer country?
Well, I think people would like to think so. We would like to imagine that we have lower crime rates today because everyone's locked up. Unfortunately, that does not bear out. The folks that study this pretty carefully do not draw that conclusion. And in fact, while the broader society has experienced a lower crime rate, what we notice over time is that the incarceration rate, which has gone nothing but up, and the crime rate has fluctuated. I mean, indeed, they're sort of disaggregated in really important ways. And what we need to care about, though, is what Jane's talking about, right? That in the communities that have most experienced incarceration, the violence rate has gone up. So if what we're seeking to do is to improve communities and to make them safer, for the people who most experience this problem, their communities mm-hmm. have gotten much less safe.
Keith, are we talking about traumatized communities, traumatized families?
I think that's right. We're talking about traumatized communities, families. We're talking about fraying of infrastructures. The churches are not as strong as they need to be. The Boy Scouts, the Girl Scouts, the schools themselves in particular are not what they need to be, in part because of this issue, this problem.
I'm curious, though, even in looking at some of the African-American men that you have been working with, and it's certainly true in this city, that the victims of at least violent crime tend to be African-Americans
sure,
as well.
Sure.
And I want to factor that into our conversation.
Yeah, that's a big problem. I primarily have worked with the drug offenders, in part because of the importance of and the prominence of substance abuse and mental illness, which is another part of the conversation as well. But there are lots of folks who have committed violent crimes. There are men whom I've worked with over the last decade or so who would say they deserve to be locked up. But there are lots of other folks who are drug offenders who could be sentenced in alternative ways. And that's a large part of the problem that we've got to grapple with.
And Heather, just going back to you about the you know, as it's called, war on drugs. I mean, if we were to rethink how we deal with certain kinds of drugs, would that, do you think, impact the incarceration rate?
Well, there's no question that if we rolled back many of the Rockefeller drug laws, so-called Rockefeller drug laws, we would see a decrease in incarceration rates. Also, we would have to deal with mandatory minimums. We now place people in prison far longer than we ever have and far longer than any other country does. So there certainly is a way that we can practically, from a policy point of view, begin the process of decarceration. I think what we need to do, though, is to persuade the nation that this is what we should be doing. And while it is true that this is very much a community problem, and I'm glad we're going to focus on that today, we also need to understand that this is, in a much broader sense, this is eroding our communities, yes, but it is also undermining our economy. It's creating unemployment problems. It's creating a profit incentive for crimes to be committed on the part of private prisons, and it's distorting our democracy. So we should care about this whether or not we care about Camden, which I also think we should do.
And distorting democracy because of voting, things like
the
right to vote.
Well, exactly. So right now we are facing this debate whether we should have the Voting Rights Act or not. And what's really interesting is at the very moment we pass the Voting Rights Act, we also begin the war on crime. And as a result of this massive war on crime, we now have scores and scores of citizens who are not part of our democracy, either because of felon disfranchisement or because the people who are in prison get to count as bodies, representational bodies for the places where they are incarcerated. Mm-hmm. They don't have a vote, but yet, so this has distorted our democracy in the most fundamental way. And again, all citizens should care that our carceral state has distorted the American state.
Right. And what's significant is what Heather just said, and that is those individuals who are incarcerated are not counted in their home communities. They are counted in the rural, oftentimes prison communities, and that is a significant distortion of democratic participation, civic participation in this country.
Jane, if I can go back, did you want to add anything to that?
I just wanted to add when Heather was talking about the drug laws and reforming the drug laws and how that could help to decarcerate that. There's another sort of easy picking that has to do with the population of parolees who are in prison, because the part of the reason why the prison population went up as much as it did was because we changed our approach to parole violators. And when they violate parole, even for minor things, they're very likely to end up going back to prison. And so a significant proportion of the prison population now is people who are on parole. And part of the problem is, of course, that we don't give any support to them when they come out. So they have a difficult time adjusting because they face so many barriers, not least of which is the felon disenfranchisement that they have, but the practical problems of housing and employment and that sort of thing. And so parole needs to possibly rethink their reaction of sending people just back to prison instead of maybe providing more support for them.
Go ahead. We're almost about to break, but go ahead.
When we bring parole in, we are really forced to recognize that while there is almost 2 million people in prison, there are more than 7 million people ensnared in this system in some form or fashion. Parole.
Probation.
And when you put that together with how many people now have criminal records, again, we are talking so much larger of a population than the people that we would imagine to be locked up in Greaterford or any of these prisons around Pennsylvania or the nation.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Heather Ann Thompson, the voice you just heard, Associate Professor of History in the Departments of African American Studies and History at Temple University. Also with us, Jane Siegel, Associate Professor of Criminology at Rutgers University in Camden, author of Disrupted Childhoods, Children of Women in Prison, and Keith Reeves. He's an Associate Professor of Political Science and Faculty Director of the Center for Social and Policy Studies at Swarthmore College, has been working in Chester, where he grew up. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Much more to talk about after this short break. We'll be right back.
Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health supports WHYY and offers a fully accredited master's degree in public health. An open house will be held Wednesday, March 5th in Room 202 of the College Building, 1025 Walnut Street. Registration by phone 215-503-0174 or online at jefferson.edu/openhouse. The Thomas Jefferson University School of Population Health, bringing health and healthcare together.
Have you ever asked yourself, am I going crazy?
The notion is that if you see things or hear things, you're going mad. But as a physician, I have to try and define what's going on and to reassure people that they're not going insane.
I'm Guy Raz, the place between madness and sanity. It's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday afternoon at 2 on WHYY.
In 1913, thousands marched on Washington, D.C. to argue for the right for women to vote. The suffragists won a constitutional amendment securing that right, but also ushered in the women's movement. 100 years later, we take another look at the suffrage movement, how it transformed the nation and how it didn't. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about the fact that the prison population in this country has increased by 500% since the 1970s. Almost half of those in prison are there for nonviolent crimes. That dramatic rise, a reflection of tougher drug laws, stricter sentencing guidelines. But there's growing evidence that mass incarceration can increase crime rates. It's devastated poor families and their communities. So today on Radio Times, is it time to rethink laws and policies intended to ensure public safety? And again, talking with Keith Reeves, Jane Siegel, and Heather Ann Thompson, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Jane, would it be fair to say that these tough laws has had this unintended consequence of increased crime rates in certain parts of the country or certain parts of cities, hurting families they're probably struggling anyway, and making it difficult for someone who gets out of prison to find a job and get out of this so-called life of crime?
Right, absolutely. It's one of these illustrations of public policy that has gone awry, and one would like to think that they were unintended consequences. Some people don't think they're unintended, that in fact this was really quite intentional. But certainly I don't think that necessarily anybody thought much about the collateral consequences of these policies and just how far-reaching they were in terms of the devastation that they could wreak on the families and the communities that are affected, mm-hmm. not to mention the individuals.
Yeah, I think that's what I would add to that, public housing, the denied public housing. So if you've got one pillar that you're denied public housing, you've got the other pillar, and that is that you have really difficult time getting work. It's not surprising, just on those two factors alone, it's not surprising that at some period of time, within 3 years, someone's going to return back to prison. And then add to that child arrears, so you've got child support that you've got to take care of, enormous, we call them landmines, that are purposely, some would argue, there to really trip up the individual such that he or she is going back to prison at some point.
Well, let me just pick up on that. Purposely, the idea is to get that person back in prison?
There's some people who believe that. So there are lots of men whom I work with who really believe that the system is systematically set up to send them back to prison. In fact, some of them have said, well, the prison guards will tell you, we'll see you in a year, see you in 2 years. So we've got to deal with those pieces systemically, housing, employment, child arrears. We are now in a knowledge-based economy, and a lot of them in my work with just are not prepared to come back to join become part of the labor force.
I mean, they don't have the skills
for this knowledge
economy.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, the broader context here is that in the last 40 years, we have moved in such a punitive direction. And were it just the fact that it was the criminal justice system, that's what we should just focus on. But as you point out, it is also the welfare system. It is the school system. It is the employment, the system of employment that we have in communities. So when all sectors are combining to work together to thwart the efforts of folks who have perhaps violated the law from getting back on their feet, or really make it difficult for the families of those people to survive in the wake of incarceration, then we have a broader social problem. I mean, it's a policy problem, as you mentioned, Jane.
Right.
Yeah,
and
go ahead,
Jane.
I think that
Heather's absolutely right, that the idea of how punitive we are, so that we've seen for the first time in the past couple of decades, for the past couple of years, we actually have seen for the first time a decrease in the size of the prison population. And there are some states that are starting to reduce their prison population. But I would submit that that is no doubt due to the fiscal problems that the states have endured. And so as a result of that, they've realized this is a very, very expensive proposition for the taxpayers to support these people in prison. And so it's for that reason they've been willing to consider decarcerating a little bit. I don't know what's going to happen once we get over this fiscal problem that the states are experiencing.
But we're talking about what it might cost to send someone to a very nice college, for instance,
exactly.
to keep someone in prison.
Absolutely.
Is there a danger, even from the work that you've done with families in Camden, that prison becomes normalized, if you know what I mean? As you said, not everyone wants – I mean, some people feel some shame about this, but nonetheless, if you have communities where – a lot of children have parents in prison. Does that become the normal experience?
Well, it certainly is a common experience, but it doesn't mean that it's something that is condoned by the community. Right. So that there's still shame associated with it, even though it is very common.
Yeah. Right. And there's some young black men, Latino men as well, who view this as a rite of passage. And that's also problematic. And how that comes into the community space, and as Jane has pointed out, it's not that it is condoned by lots of individuals, but that becomes commonplace, becomes common practice, and how the educational system, the sort of law enforcement, sort of come to combine together to really put them on a trajectory that lands them in prison, that's a real, real problem.
I'm curious about the work that you have done or are doing with some of these men. As you said, they need skills, obviously, to be able to get a job out in the community. You also want to, quote-unquote, ban the box.
Right.
And you've also supported the idea of a military option, that we should think
sure.
about the military as a possible, I guess, job for
yeah,
people coming out of
prison.
Yeah,
that's a kind of interesting piece of the puzzle. With the men I work with, I've gotten to know them very well, one-on-one mentoring. And for probably one out of four of them, if you asked him if the military were an option, would you join the military? And they say yes. And that surprised me, in fact. And what they get into is the military, particularly for African Americans, has always been an engine, an instrument of social mobility. The most famous example, of course, is Colin Powell, who himself says that if he had not been for military service, who knows where he would have ended up. But the great thing also about the military is it takes you all across the country, all across the world. You're interacting with all kinds of other individuals. There's some research that suggests that if I'm an employer and I've got someone with military background and someone who doesn't, I might favor the individual who has military service. And so I think that has to be part of the conversation of what we revisit vis-a-vis some of the public policies that we're advocating.
I got to give you a chance to – we could do a whole show about this.
That's a controversial
piece. Just based on the look on your face, Heather, but go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think there's no question that when you ask young men, particularly who are facing zero job prospects, would they or would they not consider joining the Army or the Navy or the Marines and all that that may mean, which is stability and health insurance and a purpose in life, there's no question in my mind that people would respond affirmatively. I am much more concerned, though, that we start a lot earlier and we begin with presenting options to our young people that we imagined were possible after World War II. That yes, you might join the military, but that would be one of many, many options, not the least of which would be graduating from high school, not the least of which would be getting a job in your local community. And so the kind of repair that we need to do to our community before we can even ask the question, what kind of job would you like to have? That's what I really think we need to focus on.
Go ahead, Jane.
I agree absolutely that we need to start way earlier, the whole notion of the school to prison pipeline really needs to be addressed. But just to pick up on what Keith said about the military, we do know from research that there's a couple of things that do lead to people knifing off, if you will, is desisting from participating in crime. And one of them is actually joining the military. And the other one is getting married. And we have in our prison policies an inherently anti-family policy in place so that we are eroding the institution of marriage and we are having such a significant impact on families, which are, of course, a core institution of society. And so to the extent that these policies erode that, it's very, very counterproductive.
Let me just quickly reintroduce the three of you. That's Jane Siegel. She's an associate professor of criminology at Rutgers University in Camden, author of a book that came out a while ago, I guess. 2011, not that long ago, called Disrupted Childhoods, Children of Women in Prison. Keith Reeves, associate professor of political science, faculty director of the Center for Social and Policy Studies at Swarthmore College, working on a book that explores incarceration trends among black males and has been doing a lot of work in Chester, where he grew up. And Heather Ann Thompson, associate professor professor of history in the departments of African American Studies and History at Temple University, working on a book about Attica Prison Rebellion of 1971. And she has been doing lots of work on the costs of mass incarceration. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Heather, let me go back to you. So if obviously violent people need to be behind bars, I think we can probably largely agree on that. But if we're talking about the almost half of the prison population there for some kind of nonviolent crime, instead of prison, what should we do with these people? And I realize that each one has a unique case that should be heard by somebody. But how can we rethink some of these nonviolent people?
Well, there are myriad possibilities, and lots of programs out there that are exploring the efficacy of keeping people out of prison and nevertheless having to face or take responsibility for transgressions. So we're talking about restorative justice programs, right? We're talking about community justice programs. We're talking about reducing sentences so that people, even if they do go to prison, get back to the community much more quickly. So there's no shortage of options for nonviolent offenders. But I would even submit for people that are in there for violent offenses, we need to really unpack that. We need to unpack the origins of violence in the community. Because, if we're serious about dealing with this, we know for a fact that violence comes out of lack of education and so forth.
So that's a large sociological, psychological issue as well, right?
Absolutely. And I mean, again, I'm a historian, so I'm a little biased, but yes. One of the reasons why I keep focusing on these broader, bigger questions is one of my concerns is that this extremely important work everyone is doing to remedy the problem that we've now created, we run the risk of nibbling at the margins of something that is so much more profoundly wrong with the policy. And the example that I always give to my students is, imagine, you know, during the Great Depression, a lot of great work was done in the communities to feed people, to run soup kitchens, to try to remedy the problem. But it really was not until we tackled the broader issues in the economy and the broader legal issues, got rid of convict leasing, for example, changed the way we dealt with poverty, that we made a real difference in people's lives.
Keith, did you want to add
something? Yeah, I would just add to that. We also have to include in the mix adult drug courts. And there's some work that suggests that they are incredibly effective, and there's some really interesting models going on in the country. But I think Heather is absolutely right. You have to get into the community space and re-envision jobs, mentors, more men in the community, increased support for the infrastructure that's there. You need homeowners, all of those things that really produce really healthy, mm-hmm. vibrant communities, even under segregation. Those communities were vibrant, were strong, and you didn't see the kinds of numbers, particularly black males going off to prisons, that we have been seeing over the last couple of decades.
Do they exist, Jane? All these services that we've been talking about?
Not enough. So, but the amount of money that we spend on prisons could be redirected towards provision of these kinds of services and programs. And also, there's many people who could be not just the kinds of programs that Heather talked about, but just under an alternative form of non-incarcerated supervision. Mm-hmm. So being on probation, or even if you feel that they need to be placed in some kind of institution, that it could be a community-based institution instead, so that at least they would be closer to their family and their community and make it possible to try to do a better job of maintaining their relationships with their families.
Keith, I forgot to ask you about Ban the Box, because that's another thing that I know that you're...
Yeah, it's
you're
an interesting proposition, and that is that you have some public agencies in particular who ask, have you been convicted of a crime or have you served a sentence and so on. And there's some initiatives across the country that suggest that that should be eliminated as an option, so that at least the individual who is looking to be employed or interviewed isn't tossed aside without having a chance to present him or herself and make the case for why he or she should be hired. And so that should be also considered as a real option. And it's something that we can do, and lots of other communities, government, city governments and all, have put into place.
And the idea that if you check the box, your prospective employer is going to have questions or doubts.
Yeah. We know that they
That's
will.
Right.
We,
right.
The
Heather,
studies make clear that they will.
Right. And there was a wonderful anecdote that I just wanted to recount about an ex-offender who came out of prison, applied for a job, was having so much trouble finding one, and went to the place where he was applying. The person said, "I think you'll do a great job at this." When he came in, he checked the box, and he said, "Oh, I'm sorry." And the job was cleaning portable toilets. Mm. And so somehow just having a history of a criminal record disqualified him for doing the dirtiest kind of work imaginable.
Well, and can I just add to that? I think it's very important. We don't just have boxes for employment. While that is dire on communities, we also have them in educational spaces. So mm-hmm. universities, in order to apply to get into a university, you have to check the box. In order to get financial aid in this country, you have to check the box. And so there is a double jeopardy phenomenon here. One wonders if it's constitutional that even if you've served your time, you are in perpetuity criminalized.
Let me ask you about something that I read in the New York Times. They had some really interesting and investigative pieces on mass incarceration. There's apparently a group called Right on Crime among the members, Jeb Bush, Newt Gingrich. And the quote that I read was that they, too, I think like the three of you, have some concerns about the consequences of mass incarceration. And I'm quoting here from the Times, it advocates more selective incarceration, warns that current policies, quote, have the unintended consequences of hardening nonviolent, low-risk offenders so that they become a greater risk to the public than when they entered. Do you think there is some bipartisanship on this issue, Jane?
I do think there is to an extent. I think that people who spend time looking into this and understanding the consequences begin to understand that this is counterproductive. The problem is that it's very hard for politicians, and Keith can probably speak to this better than I can, but it's very hard for politicians to retreat from a get tough on crime stance. So that
and get reelected
and
or get
re-elected. Re-elected, yes, sure. Because the public just isn't buying into that. I don't think the public understands fully what it means to have people this number of people locked up. It's very easy to say lock them up, throw away the key, they're out of sight, they're out of mind, and they just forget about them.
Sure. Keith? No, I think that's exactly right. I mean, Michael Dukakis, Swarthmore alum, ran against the first George W. Bush. Bush ran a Willie Horton sort of tough on crime policy. Even though once he was elected, he did almost nothing vis-a-vis what he was campaigning on. And so we know that there are real serious repercussions for politicians who are trying to move in a different direction.
But do you think, Heather, that there is some coming together on this issue?
There's no question that this is becoming a public conversation, and the public conversation is bipartisan to some degree. But I do think we have to be very careful. Jane mentioned that a lot of the push for decarceration right now is coming from fiscal conservatives. It's becoming too expensive. My concern is that if we only, again, tackle this from a fiscal point of view, from an economic point of view, we run some really big risks that the moment we can resume this practice, we will. The other thing is we have to begin to ask the really hard questions, and this is where the bipartisanship tends to fall away a bit. And those are questions about why is it that these particular communities are policed so much more heavily than other communities? I mean, we just speak of black men as if this is an inevitability about the profile of our incarcerated population. This is historically rooted. It is not coincidental or accidental. There is nothing inherently criminal or genetically criminal about being born African American in this country. So again, the policy questions about policing, about which schools are criminalized, which are not, which kinds of laws are implemented in which community and which are not, are much more complicated than most bipartisan discussions want to have.
Well, we are talking about the history and legacy of mass incarceration in the United States with Heather Ann Thompson, Jane Siegel, and Keith Reeves. We did want to get some callers in on our conversation after this very short break. That phone number 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Kendall Wick Press, publishers of Timmy Failure, a debut children's book written by Pearls Before Swine cartoonist Stefan Pastis. Signing at Barnes & Noble at the Court at Oxford Valley, tomorrow at 7 p.m.
As speculation swirls about why Pope Benedict XVI chose to resign, the church is dealing with the child sex abuse scandal, a money laundering probe involving the Vatican Bank, and reports of financial and sexual misconduct among church officials. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vatican correspondent John Favis. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What is the future of the Catholic Church as Pope Benedict steps down this week? Also, Europeans are worried about where their food comes from after horse meat was slipped into hamburger. Could that happen in the U.S.? That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Big Blue Marble Bookstore, an independent, locally owned bookstore in the heart of Mount Airy Village, carrying smart, fun books for all ages. For details on author events, book clubs, story times, and more, BigBlueMarbleBooks.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about rethinking incarceration, public safety. There's some growing concern that the high rate of incarceration in this country is hurting poor communities. It's overwhelming families of prisoners, actually left inmates who have served time with few job prospects. And all that has had a paradoxical effect of actually increasing the rate of crime. And again, we have three guests who have joined us talking about all of this. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Temple University's Heather Ann Thompson with us. Also, Rutgers University's Jane Siegel and Swarthmore College's Keith Reeves. Let me see what Monica has to say. Monica joining us from Brewerytown. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, yes. Hi, how are you? I just want to share my experience with a prison in the United States. I was incarcerated for 30 days for a second DUI, and it seems to me that most of the women that I met in that correctional facility were in there for the use of substances or for failing sobriety tests while they were on probation. So it looks to me like they were jailed for their addiction rather than for any... because their crime was addiction rather than... hurting other person.
Monica, or theft. I appreciate the call. Let me toss that to you, Jane Siegel.
Yes, Monica is absolutely right in her perception. Women are more likely to be imprisoned for drug offenses than men are, and many of the crimes for which they're arrested, such as prostitution and property crimes, stealing, that sort of thing, are associated with their drug habits. And some people have said that the war on drugs was really a war on women because it's had an effect on them that's really disproportionate. So she's absolutely right.
Heather, did you want to add anything to that? Okay. Keith, this is something we were talking about during the break about the fact that 1 in 9 African-American men is in prison or has been in prison.
That's right.
So
yep.
10%, yep. 1 in 9.
Yeah, that's right. And the research is very clear that 1 in 3 black men at some point in his lifetime will have served time in prison. I mean, just think about that. That's an alarming, alarming statistic. And think about the repercussions throughout his lifetime. So the lack of really meaningful living wage job prospects and the benefits that come with that, the ability to put together a pension. And as Heather pointed out, the cost to the nation is really quite significant because these individuals are not part of the labor market, so they're not paying into Social Security. There's huge impact in terms of tax revenue, GNP. Those are real significant costs that the country itself is facing. So this really ought to be a problem that all of us are concerned about.
Do you think, though, that prisons could do a better job rehabilitating people? Are they in a position to do something like that?
I believe so, but it requires really significant innovative progressive partnerships. So there's a wonderful model here at Temple University, Inside Out, which we are part of. in which you bring back the important role of higher education institutions. It's incredibly, incredibly invaluable for an individual who has been told early on that he can't accomplish anything educationally to come into a college classroom with college peers and be able to see, I can turn my life around, I can do college-level work. The confidence that that gives that individual, the hope of being able to stay on the straight and narrow, is really, really quite significant. So I would push significantly for a higher, increased role for American higher education.
Go ahead,
Jane. And one of the policies that have made that more difficult is that we eliminated Pell Grants prisoners.
That's right.
So it's made it even more difficult for them unless there are universities that are willing to extend their largesse to these folks in prison. It makes it very difficult.
Go ahead, Heather.
Well, just one of the ways to think about it, tying together this question that the caller raised about addiction and this question about young African-American men, you know, in essence, what we're talking about is the nation's most vulnerable citizens are the ones most targeted by the criminal justice system. And when I say targeted, I'm very clear when I use that word. That is to say, that's where most of the policing resources go, most of the attention of the system goes. And so rather than dealing with the addiction question as a public health issue, as Jane mentioned, rather than dealing with the issue of unemployment in poor black communities in Camden as a question of mobility, a question of education, a question of employability, we deal with these questions as criminal justice questions. And that's, again, a policy decision that we made that we are now living with.
Well, and I'm wondering, too, the fact that, more prisons, I don't have the actual number, but more prisons are private prisons.
Absolutely.
How do you factor that into our conversation?
This is a really important piece of the discussion, because one of the ways to think about it is that when states can no longer afford to run prisons, one of the most seemingly appealing options is to essentially farm this work out to a for-profit corporation. And by the way, not just for prisons, for domestic citizens, but also for immigration detention centers. That's really ground zero for privatization. And when we do that, we effectively are attaching a profit motive to our criminal justice system. We are effectively saying, and I know this is pretty brash, but we are effectively saying that we need crimes to be committed. We need people to be victimized because we need beds to be filled in order to keep stockholders happy. And this is a real problem. The other thing we need to understand is that we, in 1979, made it possible. We overhauled laws to make it possible for corporations to access that enormous body of idle labor sitting in prisons and get them to work. And essentially a return to a convict leasing system, if you will. These are, again, policy decisions that few Americans think about, but they have had a profound impact on why laws remain so punitive, why sentences remain so long, why certain communities get policed so heavily, and why, by the way, politicians are so leery of talking talking anti-prison strategies.
Because of what, lobbyists?
Because of enormous lobbying pressure, particularly from companies that belong to cumulatively to an organization called the American Legislative Exchange Council, which we've heard a lot about. Alan.
Let me just add just
go
very
ahead,
quickly. I've spent time in correctional facilities run by the state of Pennsylvania, but also private detention county jails. And anecdotally, I want to make clear, anecdotally, huge differences. So in the privatization of prisons, the staffing isn't as robust as I found in the state prisons. The training, the mentoring pieces, the educational programs and options that are offered, the mental health facilities, all of those things end up being really, really problematic, and that damages the individuals who are there, eventually who will come back home.
Hmm. Jane, did you want anything to that?
Just that there's the private prison is something very worrisome, but there's other forces as well that really keep trying to push for more prisons, and that's just the rural communities, for example. It's
rural communities.
Yes, that want to have, they see it as an employment opportunity, and a lot of the correctional guards also see it as an opportunity for employment, and so in California, for example, there's a very powerful union of correctional officers who have a vested interest in seeing that they don't close the prisons. So there's many forces arrayed against the idea of closing the prisons.
Let me get some callers back in on the conversation. We have Bernard from Stroudsburg joining us on Radio Times. And Bernard, go ahead. You are on the air.
Thank you. I'm very interested. I thank you for this time.
You're welcome.
I myself am a black male, ex-offender. Early 2000, I had a charge of illegal firearm, but I re-entered into the system through one of the programs that they had for people who were without jobs through CareerLink. I was able to get training and stay in that training. I'm a truck driver now, and I've been a truck driver for 12 years. Okay. Religion helped me really stay on my feet. Now, my thing is, they're going to spend a lot of money having these young fellas come out of the system, trying to get back into the system, reentry, but yet they're going to spend more money because they're not going to have the opportunity. Right now, they don't have that education. They don't have the opportunity because the program's been cut. So also, the corporations need to get involved. Once an offender has done their probationary time, they need to allow them not to be able to check that box. Mm. Once they check that box, they won't get the job. And I'll take your comment.
Well, Bernard, appreciate the call to Radio Times. Keith?
I would just add, I think the caller is identifying something really quite significant that has to be brought into the conversation. Earlier, we were talking about partnerships between and among correctional officials and stakeholders and so on. The faith-based community has to be part of this conversation, and they are really, really essential. I work mostly in Chester, which is an area of about 4.8 square miles, has 140 churches. So think about that, 26, 27 churches in each one of those square miles, enormous, enormous capacity there. And yet the numbers of individuals, both men and women, who are going off to prison is astounding for that community space. So there are what we call million-dollar blocks, where lots of individuals in community spaces, huge numbers of them are off to prison. There has to be a role for faith-based communities to come back and be a part of the conversation and help, particularly on the reentry side.
Do those people in prison, have they gone to church? Are they church members? Do you know?
Some of them, the religion piece is kind of interesting. The individuals I've worked with have come to religion, in part because they are there. They have this opportunity to sort of really get their lives around. And my own anecdotal experience is that I can offer an individual mm-hmm. job, the educational prospects, the housing piece, but if he or she hasn't really changed in head and heart, and this is where the call is identifying an important variable, the religion piece is important. It helps them because we all go through life and we have tough times and all. That religion piece helps you stay on the straight and narrow.
Go ahead, Heather.
This issue of bringing in lots of partners, I think, is really important. We have here's something interesting. This is not the first time we've had a major prison crisis that is mostly targeted at African Americans. Right after the Civil War, we had 4 million newly freed African Americans, and immediately Southern states went about criminalizing spaces where African-Americans lived and worked, and immediately the jails went from being all white to all black, and there was a real crisis of incarceration after the Civil War, one that, again, resulted in convict leasing. Those felons couldn't vote because of disfranchisement laws. I mean, an eerily similar thing to what happens after the Civil Rights 60s. And what it took to undo that was a coalition effort. Interestingly, it took religious people pointing to the immorality of the system. It took a labor movement looking at these prisons and saying, look, this is unfair job competition. It took prisoners themselves standing up and saying, this is inhumane. We need basic human rights. And it took essentially folks that worked in those sort of reentry communities at the time mm-hmm. to speak up about the crisis that was caused. We have all the pieces in place to do that again. It's going to take all those pieces to decarcerate again. But the fundamental piece of it has to be everyone sees that they have a stake in this problem.
Jane, let me go back to you and actually go from history to even some of the families that you talked to, interviewed for your book. What it's like for, let's say, a young man, a child, you know, whose mom or dad is in prison, and how they're able to navigate the distances, that sense of loss. And I guess for some, they're able to see their way through it. But I think for a lot, they suffer because of that.
They do. I think a lot of it depends, of course, on the context, the living arrangements that they had before the parent went to prison, because a lot of parents who are in prison were not living with their children beforehand, especially the men. But almost no matter what the circumstances were, they still miss the parent. It's a very difficult emotional terrain for them to traverse. And one of the problems, a major problem, is that it's so difficult for them to maintain contact with their parent. They cannot call their parent. They can't come home with a good report card and call up and say, oh, I got a great report card today, and share that with their parent. They have to rely on their parents calling them. And that the cost of prison calls is inflated by, again, the profit motive, because there's a surcharge placed on those calls. And it, for these families, many of whom are poor, it becomes unaffordable. So they can't even speak to them. Prisons are far away. We stick them out in those rural communities. And it's very, very difficult for children to get there. They're totally reliant on adults to take them there. And so many prisoners never see their children for the entire time that they are incarcerated. And so, of course, the children grow apart, and it makes it a challenge for them to reconnect when they come back.
Right. And on this point, very quickly, imagine that you are in an urban space, you're going to visit a loved one in a rural facility, and all of the paperwork is not in place. So I've been there in places in which the kid is excited to see his dad, her dad, and the parent, for whatever reason, has not put the child on the official list. And you've come 3 or 4 hours and expended all of that money, enormously, enormously crushing for the kid, for the parent, but also for the individual who is incarcerated. Mm-hmm.
And this is a problem that's getting much, much worse with every passing year. The number of mothers in prison has doubled. The number of children who can see their parent has gone down by almost 30%, with these parents moving farther and farther away from the center cities. And again, Jane mentioned this, but I think it really requires an asterisk and a star by it. Why is it impossible for children to talk to their parents? It's impossible because certain companies, global tech, phone company, among many, literally get kickbacks from state prison systems to get a contract to be the only game in town when it comes to using phone cards in the prison. Not just phone companies, but charging exorbitant fees, but also anything that a prisoner needs. You can't just go to a Walmart and send a package. You have to use specific vendors, private vendors. So again, people are making an extraordinary amount of money off of the misery of children, to put it quite bluntly.
Mm-hmm. I hate to end on that note, but we have to do that. And my thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. A very interesting and important discussion. Heather Ann Thompson, Associate Professor of History in the Departments of African American Studies and History at Temple University. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Jane Siegel, Associate Professor of Criminology at Rutgers University in Camden across the river. Thank you very much as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
And Keith Reeves, Associate Professor of Political Science and Faculty Director of the Center for Social and Policy Studies at Swarthmore College, and thank you very much as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about this program, including Facebook, Twitter, email, the archives, podcast, Sirius Satellite Radio. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.